welcome to this month's episode of the Bike Portland podcast about bikes and low-car life and PDX. Taped here at the Open Roads Broadcasting Studio, I'm Lillian Kerr-Bake.
And I'm Michael Anderson. Each month we go in-depth on a subject that matters to Portlanders who get around without a car.
And we do it in the time it takes the average Portlander to get to work.
This month on the show, we're talking about birth.
Or maybe rebirth.
We're talking about the moment that people become biking advocates.
What pieces of alchemy lead people to make that leap?
What paths do people tend to follow from ordinary Portlander to bike user to bike advocate?
How does that path differ based on our income, our color, and our gender?
Why do bikes seem to be so good at attracting certain people to become advocates?
And if they're so good at attracting passionate fans, why haven't they seen more success?
And what can the bike advocates we have today do to be fruitful and multiply?
So today, as our guest, we have Michael Tete, the CEO of the Community Cycling Center. And Michael's here because he sort of originally conceived of and pushed this concept of avenues to advocacy, which is a way for people that are not necessarily involved in transportation advocacy to access and learn about how to become transportation advocates, which is sort of materialized as a web toolkit. But there's the Community Cycling Center, which I work for as my day job.
I was going to say, this is Lily's boss. We're interviewing Lily's boss.
Because we're a completely unbiased podcast.
Right, yeah.
Anyway,
I don't have any opinions about bicycling.
Yeah, exactly. So we've invited Michael just to kind of have a conversation about sort of what the changing face of advocacy looks like and kind of where we see bicycle advocacy 2.0 or 3.0. I don't know what version we're in.
It's a continuum.
Yeah.
Right.
So for the purposes of today's podcast,
right,
we're going to call Michael Anderson Mike, and then Michael Tete Michael, just so that it's easier for you guys
Sounds
to tell.
Great.
You guys have pretty distinctly different voices, but... thank you, Michael, for coming and joining. We're excited to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
Well, so I wanted to start with the sort of origin story for each of us. What was the first moment that each of the three of us decided that sort of we had become political about bike stuff? Maybe it wasn't something we realized at first. Do you want to start, Lily?
Yeah, I guess so. A lot of the reasons for me that I started biking were very deeply political in nature, but was also just informed by income. Like, I started riding a bike because I couldn't afford to have a car. And there's something very visceral about riding your bike, especially as someone who is already kind of agitating, politically active, because at that time I was pretty highly identified with radical political groups, much less mainstream. And
give us one example.
Food Not Bombs, for example.
Right.
Being affiliated with those, everything was seen as a deeply political act to me. But the fact that you're so vulnerable on the road, I started to see how that really translated into riding a bike being a political act. And I don't think I started to become articulate about what politics of bikes meant beyond drivers, you don't own the road, until I was much later, until in many ways, until my kind of personal politics had mainstreamed a little and I started to understand how to get things done. I think one of the challenges I discovered is that radical bike activism was very much seen as fringe and wasn't an effective way to get things kind of pushed through, and it just ended up being sort of critical mass, and in the end we would, you know, go have soda and eat dumpster dive food at the end of critical mass. It wasn't necessarily
did the critical mass in Portland, did they drink soda afterward too?
I never went to critical mass in Portland because
okay,
it was
right,
already dead
right,
by
okay,
the time
dead.
I
yeah,
got
it,
here
got it, got it.
No the critical mass in Cincinnati is very cute though.
Yeah great.
Did you ever go to critical mass in Portland, Michael?
No, never have.
Yeah, so I got into bikes by way, so I was a reporter in Clark County, Washington, 500,000 people in this very suburban developed county, completely developed after the car almost, and I realized that of that you had like maybe 100,000 people who were either in households that didn't have cars or their cars were about to fall apart at any moment, and if they did then their lives would be completely derailed because we built this county in this stupid way. And so I got into trying to think about how to change that for more people, and got into transit in Portland, and then quickly realized while riding transit and my bike in Portland that, like, that combination of bike and transit was completely essential to making my life convenient without a car, even in Portland. And so got into so my agenda is sort of to, like, make it easier for people of every income, basically, to live without a car. And I feel like a bike is an important way to do that. You can't do it without some of that biking. So it was a very intellectualized decision, I guess, in my case. And I still find it a little bit hard to get really emotional about bike activism, except when I've just been, like, almost sideswiped, in which case it's very easy for me to get
yeah. It's amazing how quickly that sort of...
Yeah.
I think the impact for bicycling in my life was really emotional and very visceral. And it only became more than just something I was passionate about and something that I thought was really fun when I got out of graduate school in 2005 and spent a full year in the city of Portland. When I was in high school, I didn't really understand shifting demographics, gentrification, redlining, or ways in which the neighborhoods that I grew up in might change. But by the time I got back to Alberta Street in 2005, I could see change had happened, and I could see that bicycles were the vehicle of that change in many ways, at least the ways in which I perceived it. And at that point, there was a convenient, if not wonderfully coincidental, intersection between something I was very passionate about and something that, although I did not know how, was extremely relevant from a political standpoint, I could tell there was something there because of the emotional reaction I had to all of the bicycles that were out and who was riding them.
What was that emotional reaction?
I was upset. I was upset because of the change that I saw. And that was kind of the immature anger of a person that really liked his hometown and didn't want anything to change. Immature anger of a person that just wanted things to be the way that they had always been, and I didn't want a whole bunch more people showing up in the place that I grew up. And at the same time, the folks were really doing things that I really enjoyed as well, and some of what makes Portland a great place. So it was mixed emotions, but as opposed to just staying upset about the change that was happening, I really wanted to find a way to engage with it. And that's when I tried to get jobs at bike shops. Couldn't get a job anywhere in town, but got an interview at the Community Cycling Center doing retail sales and outreach. And again, that was the fall of 2005.
Mm-hmm. Sweet. And the subtext of this is what your race, how do you describe your race as black, I assume?
Yeah, you could go there. My father's from Ghana. My mother is from Salmon Creek, Washington. It's so about the opposite ends of the world.
Am I presuming to think that that was part of the emotion? Was it this cultural transition in central Portland?
I think that's it. But then it's, aside from it just being kind of a cultural transition, it's just the ways in which your hometown changes. And that's where it's less abstract and less academic. Mm-hmm. It's more visceral when it comes to change writ large, as opposed to specific demographic shifts or anything of the sort.
People, so the goal of this podcast is to hopefully talk about, to understand the sort of the path that people take from not caring about this stuff to caring about this stuff to being active about this stuff. Do we have any personal experiences we'd like to share of, like, observations we've made? Like, have we seen somebody in our lives make that jump?
I can think of a good one.
Great.
Really, a young man that lived for a long time in New Columbia, named Egbavado Ananuko.
This is the North Portland mixed-income community.
That's right.
Yeah,
right, out there in North Portland. And he helped to found a group out there in New Columbia called We All Can Ride. They have the best logo ever. they have the best catchphrases, building a future city with bicycles. It's just phenomenal. And I saw him go from being a advocate for food justice and an amazing community educator and community leader into one that was able to fully embrace bicycling as a tool for empowerment and an engaging device for demographics in New Columbia that are, one, extremely diverse, about 18 different countries represented, and also tend to be really young. The vast majority, not the vast, maybe 52% of the young people out there are under the age of 18. So it's like half kids from all different countries. And what more compelling tool than the bicycle? And that's a group we all can ride that continues to advocate for bicycling and active transportation in that community. But he was a real spark for that group, and it was phenomenal to see him go from someone that just appreciated bicycling to someone who was actually in a position to help advocate for change in his community.
Was there a catalyst for that? Was there an event? Was there a person that caused that to happen?
You know, I think when people, because I haven't had an opportunity to talk with him, like, what was the one turning point you? But if I could guess, it may be like it is for a lot of us. It's kind of a preponderance of opportunity or challenge that can lead us to really sticking up for something that we believe in, or really promoting or advocating for something that we find to be very important. And I think it's within that context, then there are a number of people who are right on the verge from going from appreciation to advocacy when it comes to active transportation, and we need to find what tools they need in order to get fully engaged.
Mm-hmm.
This is kind of an older story now, but if you guys remember the very significant, I think 2007 it was, where we had two right hooks within the course of 2 weeks where folks died, and one was Brett Jeralemick, who worked at Bike Gallery, and the other was Tracy Sparling, who was a young student. And Tracy, both of those intersections now have bike boxes, and which at the time weren't a thing that anybody was doing in the United States. And Tracy Sparling's was not an avid cyclist before she passed. She's just a art student who got around on her bike. And the cycling community really came out to support her family. And her aunt, Susie Cabata, ended up doing a ton of advocacy around bike safety. I mean, she came out and testified for Safe Sound and Green. She came on the Ride of Silence. She testified in support of bike boxes. She had never really been involved in any bicycle advocacy, but her niece's death really sparked in her, like, there are engineering solutions that could have prevented my niece's death. And, you know, someone needs to talk about them. For the couple of years following Tracy Sparling's death, she was still very active and pushing, and she is exactly the kind of partner that's really helpful to have, which is someone that isn't a bike evangelist by nature, but is a safety evangelist that helps, through a personal connection, really push for safer bicycling facilities, because it's important for everyone.
Yeah.
So
that's a very obviously sort of bad experience that brought her into this. It sounds like the fellow you're describing, I assume it was a series of good experiences or something like that that seemed to have motivated his transition or journey.
Right. Yeah.
Is one more powerful than the other? Obviously, we need both. Maybe biking in Portland is so safe that maybe that's less motivating. There are fewer bad experiences than there used to be.
I think that all you have to do is go past 82nd and you no longer find that true. I mean, one of the things that, so I was recently working on doing a lot of connections with new partners out in East Portland. We previously have only really worked in North and Northeast Portland in the Community Cycling Center, but clearly there's a deep need for safer facilities, more people supporting each other riding out in East Portland. And so we're starting to build partnerships out there. And absolutely no one I talk to in East Portland is like, oh, well, it's perfectly safe for biking out here, so we don't need help. Like, they're all just like, oh, thank gosh, someone's coming out here. I mean, down to the really simple stuff, like bike shop deserts.
Right.
You know, if you are out in a part of East Portland that's poorly served by transit to get from one part of East Portland to another rather than just downtown, which is what all of the transit in East Portland is good for, taking you downtown, you might have to walk 4, 5, 6, 7 miles with your flat tire if you don't have facilities to change it at. I think that one of the reasons we see ourselves falling into complacency in Portland is because the people that have been doing it for a long time tend to already gravitate towards the parts of town where it is safer to bike.
Right.
And that new breed of advocates that might be motivated by negative experiences, or not necessarily negative experiences, but just wanting to change something into a more positive version, the low-hanging fruit, so to say, in terms of safety and route, those folks are not the old school bike advocates. We don't see people that have been doing bike advocacy since the early 2000s moving out to 122nd in droves right now. So you're not going to see the kind of advocacy out there yet. It's not so much that there aren't the experiences where people want to get involved in advocacy, because I hear that when I talk to folks out there. It's like, what's next? What do you do next?
It's a sense of direction or like accomplishment.
I guess a couple of points. And the first one is kind of bigger, and it may point to some of our assumptions. And I think generally, Portland is viewed as one of the most livable places in the United States. And part of the struggle that we have, given the reputation for this metropolitan area, is that once people get here, if they have recently arrived, they may feel as though they are essentially living the most sustainable life that they have ever had just by being here. And one thing that we've done, which builds on a legacy of active transportation advocacy, Portland Trailblazer World Championship, and a bottle bill in the late 70s and early 80s. Where
I like
we,
the sports linkage there.
Well, absolutely.
Right.
Well, there was a lot, and I know because they're my friend's parents that were around in the late 70s and the early 80s, and the kind of really progressive, very awesome things that were happening in this part of the world were really unique. And it's within that context, then there was a very intentional push to attract and retain exactly who it is that we have in our Portland metropolitan area now.
Hmm.
And it's worked to a T. Now, what do we do with that?
Yeah, the attract and retain, what you mean, political progressives?
Young, well-educated, working people here in the Portland metropolitan area. Now we have them, and we have the lowest rental vacancy rates of just about anywhere in the country. We have top five rates of people moving here to the Portland metropolitan area. It's phenomenal. But the bar nationally, in my view, for what the ideal should look like from a sustainability standpoint is so low that there was for many years the idea or the notion that we were essentially leading that. And it's gotten us to 6% bicycle mode share. And I hope that we're going to be able to push past that. But it means that we're going to need to come up with, as Lillian mentioned, a volume two or volume three, a new edition, and an opportunity to see what that next level looks like.
So I feel like that's a good segue to the third section of our talk, which is what are some solutions? What are some ways that we can build more advocates? It's to the point of each of you guys just now, I feel like, to the extent that we're talking about East Portland, I feel like there's a, if we can get the street fee money flowing, a lot of the benefits will flow to East Portland and people will see those streets getting better. The activists on this in East Portland have been working for years to get this stuff going. They've done a great job. I feel like the most successful advocacy in the city for transportation stuff has been the East Portland Action Plan, and they're about to get that payoff. So hopefully that motivates people to come back to those meetings and keep pushing for more, I suppose.
Yeah, I hope so. And at the same time, I'm worried that we have a political climate in the city of Portland that does not favor innovation or initiative associated with active transportation infrastructure improvements. It's within this context we're working that is a weak mayor system, so it's not like Chicago or New York where the mayor says it and it goes in a major way. It's more that you try to find three votes and there's a series of compromises and a bunch of political proxies that are part of the process. And I hadn't been close to a political process before the street fee, that it was a little disheartening to be engaged in that process for a whole host of ways. But at the same time, it also reinforced that we're gonna need to come up with an environment for advocacy here in Portland that will allow us to overcome the limitations that we see within that political structure and that political environment.
One of the things that I still see is that the committees that regularly get to make decisions on spending money, allocating projects, tend to have at most one East Portland representative. And that person has usually been serving on that committee as the only East Portland person for 10 years mm-hmm. or more. Mm-hmm. I've seen this on a budget advisory committee, on the pedestrian advisory committee, that you end up with this tokenization of someone based on their geography. I think some of that has to do with class representation. Some of it just has to do with the sheer burden of getting to a 5:30 mm-hmm. p.m. meeting downtown when you live on 178th. I'm interested to see what the next stage of public engagement around this is. And maybe it's not that we start feeding people into committees necessarily, that we really do focus on those sort of opportunities that are specifically going out to a neighborhood.
So what are some things that could lower the bar for somebody to become engaged if they're a East Portlander? How can they become? Do they need information? Do they need experience? Do they need money? I don't know. They need childcare?
I think all of those.
Yeah, all of those things. But I think, as you mentioned earlier, they have their whole act together. We were at a meeting at City Hall the other day, and we had four people out of a room of 12 advocates who were representing East Portland in motion. They have a full set of projects that are already listed and ready to go. And as you said, I think they have actually been some of the most effective geographically of any group that we've seen in the metropolitan area in recent times. Now the question is, how much progress are we going to see and how swiftly? What kind of quality are we going to see from our transportation system? And what does good look like? And what does great look like? And what does even better beyond that? And I think that's really the great challenge and opportunity for us. But I find it difficult to imagine a time when we're going to be able to push TriMet to improve the quality and quantity of bicycle parking spaces at transit centers, so that that first and last mile bike that's an option in a place like the Netherlands becomes an option in a place like the city of Portland. Because right now we're looking at a handful of Staples, right. No room for bikes on the TriMet trains, as it were. I think they're thinking about putting an extra bike on the front of the buses.
It sounds like we're finally getting three racks
on what? The front of the buses.
Really?
I heard that they're going to pilot it on a couple buses. That's finally, which they, I mean, this is like the eighth time they've said
times,
this. Yeah. But I think that I got the impression that there was more. I feel like you would have known this, though, so maybe I dreamed it.
Maybe not.
Maybe I dreamed it.
In our dreams, there will be three bikes on each bus. If East Portland Action Plan, East Portland in Motion have been successful, what's one lesson that we can draw for people who don't know about that, maybe from other cities? What's something that
meet
can
people
replicate?
Where they are?
Okay, so what have they done to meet people where they are?
I mean, most of the committee projects that they've been hosting out there have been out in East Portland, and it hasn't just been open house, which is what we commonly see when essentially the city's looking for feedback from local communities, is they host one open house on one night at, you know, out in Southwest or something.
But they've staffed, like they've hired Laura Wintergreen, who's a former transportation specialist person, to be the East Portland Action Plan
and like do all of the wonky hard
in East Portland
stuff and
hosts the meetings.
Yes.
Right. So I feel like that, and that's with city like general fund dollars.
I don't know if it's general. I'm not going to say where the money exactly comes. It might be federal.
I think that's really
it might
remarkable
be federal flow
like,
through.
Are they going to do that with Southwest? I assume so, but I don't know.
Well, Southwest has not. I will say that like Southwest is underserved on a transportation basis, but they haven't necessarily been suffering from a lack of representation or a lack of urgency or a lack of resources to advocate for themselves. I think that there's a ton of improvements to be made in Southwest. We all know this. It's the most unwalkable part of Portland, pretty much. Tend to have a higher income, tend to be older, and tend to have a little more time for.
Right. And my worry is that those people are not representative. But I think that's better than nothing. Do you guys have any experiences with people coming to realize that this is part of their lives worth focusing on?
I think you got to approach it from two different angles. You have to help to engage traditional or longstanding active transportation advocates in the work of creating a more diverse and inclusive active transportation advocacy movement, because of the compelling reasons that there are these amazing home runs and these epic wins available for some of our most vulnerable populations on one hand. And then on the other hand, there's an opportunity to meet people where they're at, and help them understand the role transportation plays in their everyday life, the way in which it can help to provide economic, emotional, and at the same time health benefits for the ways in which they're living and working in the world. And I think it's within that context, then you have to make this case compelling. But your audience is about as different as it could be sometimes. And then other times there's significant intersection.
Is that the Bicycle Transportation Alliance teaming up with Opal on Youth Pass and therefore sort of lending political weight to this advocacy effort for high school students riding transit, which doesn't have a direct connection to biking, but like, does that lead to like the permeation of a multimodal transit system thinking in some way that it didn't before? Like, how much of this is sort of like inclusion theater and how much of it is actually going to lead to systemic change? What's that look like, I wonder?
And I think that's worth worrying about. It depends on the situation. And there are a bunch of different ways to get folks engaged. But I think ultimately that's the overall goal, is getting people engaged and going from either completely unaware to appreciation or awareness, and then from awareness and appreciation to advocacy. And it's at that point where you kind of turn the corner into engagement that I think that's where, from a multimodal standpoint, I think that's where we all benefit. Because now we have another actively engaged and informed advocate for the issues that they find most relevant. And I think the more that we can work cross-modally, the more that we can work across-organizationally, and the more in which we can get folks that would otherwise not have any engagement from a political process or from a policymaking process engaged as a stakeholder, the better.
So what's the scenario there? 17-year-old wants a transit pass, goes to Reynolds School District. The good guys win, gets a transit pass, thanks in part to the efforts of bike advocates. How does that lead to them?
I think it's really individual, but I think we see it all the time. I mean, sometimes what you see is you get people that get really excited when they're able to see, especially young people, which is part of one of the great things about what Opal does, is that they tend to activate right. young people that see that they make a difference in a process on anything they care about are far more likely to be interested in advocating for things for the future. And that might be bikes. It might be connections to reducing prison recidivism using bikes in their community. Like the ways in which they're able to see transportation transform their own communities through health, through fun, through social connections, what ends up being the more big wins or small wins that you see when you start, no matter what you start on, makes you want to keep doing this work. I mean, I don't think any of us would still consider ourselves politically bikey if we had never felt like we had a win.
Right.
And I think that as much as we can look at some of the positive examples, I can look to one potentially negative example when there isn't quality engagement from key stakeholders. And it was when the Portland Bureau of Transportation went to do an open house out at David Douglas High School. And here in Portland, David Douglas is the largest high school in the state of Oregon. And it serves a really broad demographic of people. And they had done relatively poor outreach, the Bureau did, and relatively last minute outreach. And they ended up getting a room full of older, crankier people that didn't want to see any changes or any improvements at all and were complaining vaguely about the ways in which parking spaces on street would go away with significant improvements. And in the context of that conversation, a otherwise pro-active transportation principal there at David Douglas ended up having to come out and kind of placate the crowd by saying that maybe the idea of having those improvements in active transportation weren't so great. And that's just because of who ended up being in the room. And that's not helpful for the Bureau. That's not helpful for the community. And it's not even an accurate representation of who's out there. It's just who happens to be able to attend a meeting relatively last minute and who had gotten communication through those regular channels.
Yeah.
And that's what we really, really saw with the 2035 plan meetings, is that the community that was able to activate and able to pack the room, which was Swan Island, was 90% of all of the commentary at all of the open houses for the 2035 plan. I mean, it was just overwhelming how there'd be 90 people for public comment and 85 of them would be talking about Swan Island. Mm-hmm. And that's because Swan Island was able to organize. But so, I mean, that's just sort of like you end up with this false representation. And this is just community organizing 101. If you're not already working and functioning and having the support of the communities that you hope are represented at the table, you can't necessarily get them to just show up at random at David Douglas High School on a Tuesday night.
Right.
So
you were talking about young people becoming engaged and getting wins.
Yeah.
I think that's something we saw in the early 2000s. A group of young people became a core of bike advocacy in the country. I think it's also something we saw in the 70s. And in the 70s, we created this breed of folks who've been with us since then, leading the advocacy movements, the Rex Burkholders and Mia Burks and
Earl Blumenauer's,
exactly. And one of those guys, Earl Blumenauer, who happened to be on council at the time, created a class or co-created a class that's supposed to bring people into the fold of advocates and educate them about the ways to get involved with the city to build this, I think he called it an advocacy infrastructure the other day in an interview. And so we should talk about that a little bit. Have you guys taken this class?
Yeah.
I haven't, no.
You should. It's great.
I've taken it 3 times.
Yeah. Free class, paid for by the city at PSU. Every fall. It's led by the former head of Metro and bigwig at Streetcar, one of the sort of insiders.
Yeah. And it's essentially a bunch of different things over a course of, Tuesday nights. So you really learn the in-depth history of transportation in Portland, but you also learn the whole time you theoretically have a project you want to work on, which is how most people get involved in it, is they want a speed bump on their street, or they're really into bike advocacy, or want to be. And then you spend your whole time in that class, your homework, which it's a citizen activist class, so it's not deeply homework led or anything, but is like you have to now call someone who works at this. You have to figure out who.
And even better, the
city
has to take your call.
Yeah,
that's a mandate for the employees of the transportation department. When somebody calls from that class, they have to work with them.
Wow.
Yeah, and then at the end, there's everybody kind of does their project, and then a couple get selected to do their presentations, usually in front of the director of PBOT. And what's important about it is that it is accessible to people who are just interested in working on a single transportation project and have no idea where to start. And it's free for citizen activists. If you can make it down to PSU in the fall,
2 hours
in the evening, it's totally worth taking. But one of the big struggles is that you have to be able to do that. I mean, it's a big chunk of time, but it's been running forever, like 25 years now or something, right?
It's really
phenomenally long.
I feel good. I feel like we know exactly how to create all of the vast majority of society that we need to agree that this is a great idea, that we need good biking. We figured it out.
Yeah, we outlined a 3-step process. 1, find people. 2, ? 3, create bike advocates.
Yes, right. That's right. Okay, great.
Do you have a low-car tip of the month for us, Michael, as our special guest today?
Go for a walk and walk with a friend. And when you're out, take the stock of the infrastructure that you have where you live or wherever it is that you happen to be walking. And I think it's within that context, then you may consider yourself to be an armchair transportation infrastructure inspector, right? And I think when we begin looking really intently at the infrastructure that we take for granted that allows us to get to where we want to be safely, then we begin to really appreciate some of what it takes in order to make that happen. Curbs are expensive and asphalt's really expensive, but I think it really is important for us to consider the ways in which that walk may be possible for any of us, and it might not be possible for somebody else, even within the same city. And so I would say take a walk where you live and work and play, and then take a walk where you don't, and where there may be challenges, if you want to find motivation to get out there and advocate for increases in the quality and quantity of active transportation infrastructure and access.
So slow down your rocketing 12-mile-an-hour speed down to a nice 3 miles per hour,
right,
and the world will become clear.
Yes.
Great. Lily, do you have any TriMet tweets?
I do. Okay, I want to point out that Michael tried to make these multimodal because my TriMet tweets were getting a little too negative, he thought.
I feel like TriMet tweets, many TriMet tweets are positive, but you've expressed several times you wanted to make them more positive, and I thought...
I try to keep them positive.
We could have a larger pool.
There was a lot of...
I'm trying to tie it into the show as well.
There was a lot of positive tweets because of the huge success that happened this past month. Opal, who we've mentioned multiple times,
yes,
was successful in getting the transfer time extended.
That's great.
So now your transfer time lasts 2.5 hours. Go By Bike says, overheard on TriMet bus in front of valet. Driver to no one in particular. That bike concierge service, a little bit of Amsterdam. Awkward TriMet. Damn, kids these days dress so sloppy and careless, decrees old man wearing sweatpants and Velcro shoes. Quitoxic Bell says, on bus with seats roped off as biohazards and the driver is wearing latex gloves. Should I be concerned? And that's our show.
That's our show.
You can subscribe to the show at bikeportland.org/podcast and send us any comments you have at podcast@bikeportland.org.
You can spread the word about the show by searching for Bike Portland on iTunes and leaving a review.
You can follow me at Anomalily on Twitter. Michael?
And you should visit the Community Cycling Center at communitycyclingcenter.org.
Or up at the shop on 17th and Alberta.
And you can follow Bike Portland on Twitter and Facebook, too. I'm Mike Anderson, Bike Portland's news editor.
I'm Lillian Kerbake, your podcast producer. Thanks for listening. Until next time, remember to exit through the back.
Pass on the left.
And don't forget to thank your bus driver.
You guys could only hear the voice of myself that I hear in my head.
I know. Well, I don't know. What you got going right now is dreamy. So
all right.
They could go good.